and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Russia's foreign minister said today that the Taliban have accepted an invitation to attend talks on the future of Afghanistan to be held in Moscow on September 4th. Sergei Lavrov said that the aim of the talks is to encourage the Taliban to abandon hostilities, to engage in a dialogue with the Afghan government, and to protect Russian citizens in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, hopes for a temporary halt in the fighting have broken down following a mass kidnapping and a rocket attack on the presidential palace as President Ashraf Ghani was giving a speech. Next, Mumia Abu-Jamal has been in prison in Pennsylvania since 1981 after being accused and convicted of killing a policeman. He was on death row until 2011 when his sentence was converted to life without parole. Mumia and his supporters have always maintained his innocence, and he will be in court again next week in Philadelphia. He'll be in court on August the 30th pursuing a new legal strategy that argues that Ronald Castile, a former district attorney whose office prosecuted the case, was improperly involved in his appeal after he became a state Supreme Court justice. Then American prisoners are going on strike today all across the country. The action will continue through September 9th, which marks the anniversary of the deadly uprising at the Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York. But the strike isn't necessarily political in nature. Prisoners want to draw attention to prison conditions and exploitative labor practices, and they want their work to be valued by society. And then today marks the 47th anniversary of the death of George Jackson. We take a look at his legacy and present-day significance. And finally, voting rights activists in Georgia are decrying a state plan to close two-thirds of the polling stations in a predominantly black county. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a formal protest with the county's electoral board. Even the Republican nominee for governor has urged officials to abandon the plan. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Nicole Roussel. I'm a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. As you heard in our introductions, we're going to air an interview with Brian Terrell about Russia preparing talks with the Taliban without the U.S., but instead, we're breaking in with news on the Manafort trial.
In breaking news, the jury has reached the verdict in the trial of Paul Manafort, who was, for a brief period of time, the chairman of Donald Trump's presidential campaign in the summer of 2016. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer for more than a decade, was also in court today, where he pled guilty to multiple charges. The jury in the Paul Manafort trial has been in deliberations for 4 days, and after several back-and-forth questions with the judges, have delivered their result. Nicole, it appears that they have delivered a guilty verdict on Paul Manafort for 8 of the 18 counts, serious counts, 5 counts of tax evasion, 2 counts of bank fraud, and failure to disclose a foreign bank account. A big deal. This was the big sort of primal moment for the Mueller investigation.
It was. But I will also note the judge has declared a mistrial on 10 of those 18 counts. And as you said, Brian, a lot was riding on this verdict, but the jury is deadlocked on more than half the charges. The mainstream media has been calling this a victory for the Mueller probe already. But what do you think this means?
Well, it is a victory because if they had failed to come up with any conviction, the Mueller probe would be in very serious trouble. There would be nothing really to show for it. But let's look at the charges. Guilty verdict on 8 of the charges. What are they? 5 counts of tax evasion. That means Paul Manafort went overseas working for Viktor Yanukovych, the then president of Ukraine, was receiving money from the Yanukovych government or for the Party of Regents, Yanukovych's party, and failing to disclose that money when he filed his taxes. 2 other counts of bank fraud and 1 count of failing to disclose the existence of a foreign bank account. Now, frankly, that has nothing to do with Russian collusion. I mean, that's the thing. The Mueller probe needed a conviction on something. They have something. Manafort was very vulnerable. Michael Cohen is clearly very vulnerable. They undoubtedly engaged in what lobbyists do, which is a lot of corrupt practices. The jury came back and rendered a guilty verdict. But again, not on the issue of Russia collusion. And I think that will get lost in the headlines about this.
I think that's already gotten lost. And as you know, as these conversations have been going on over the past couple of weeks, the mainstream media has really been conflating Russia and Ukraine. So I would love to hear a little bit more analysis from you, Brian, on that first. And secondly, you know, I'd be really interested to see how many people up on Capitol Hill, how many people on K Street would also be, you know, guilty of these sorts of charges. If that kind of intensive investigation had been launched against them.
Well, those are important subjects, important questions. I do want to mention, though, that before we get to that, we should talk about what this plea deal with Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, might mean not only for Michael Cohen, he's going to go to prison, but what it might mean for Donald Trump. And I want to read to you a little bit from breaking news story here at Sputnik News website. U.S. President Donald Trump's former longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty Tuesday to 8 charges, which included tax fraud and making false statements. Counts 1 through 5 are for tax evasion. Count 6, false statements to a financial institution. Count 7, willful cause of unlawful corporate contributions. And count 8, excessive campaign contribution. The former longtime lawyer for Donald Trump said in court that at the direction of the, quote, candidate for federal office, close quote, he arranged payments, quote, for principal purpose of influencing election. That purportedly or suggests that that was about the $130,000 hush money payment to Stormy Daniels, who apparently who says that she had an affair with Donald Trump. That was hush money so that Stormy Daniels wouldn't talk about it. What Michael Cohen, who at one time said he would take a bullet for Donald Trump, is basically saying here with this a plea is that he was under the direction of the candidate for federal office, that must be Donald Trump, and that he was making payments for principal purpose of influencing the election. That would mean not properly reporting a campaign contribution. That would make Cohen and presumably, maybe perhaps, a Donald Trump susceptible to this kind of additional allegation for the Mueller probe. But let's make it also clear for our audience that Michael Cohen's arrest was not actually a part of the Mueller probe. Mueller may have referred this case to the Southern District of New York. The FBI then raided Michael Cohen's apartment, his offices, his home, his hotel. They seized tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of documents, files, communications between him and his principal client, that would be Donald Trump, and using that information that had been seized, even though Michael Cohen had been cooperating with the Mueller probe, they seized this information. They used this information, which Donald Trump at the time said this is a breach of confidentiality, meaning lawyer-client confidentiality agreements. They seized this materials and then proceeded with the prosecution of Michael Cohen. Now, Michael Cohen at first said, I'll take a bullet for Donald Trump, or he used to say that. He's now clearly saying, my family comes first, country comes first. He's willing, clearly, to do something to lessen his punishment, which, of course, could be 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, or more in prison. But there are other contrary reports that say there's no deal here that requires Michael Cohen to actually testify against Donald Trump. These are the kind of things that we don't yet know. But again, even though Cohen's plea deal is not part of the Mueller probe, even though we have Manafort being found guilty on 8 of the 18 counts, again, tax evasion, bank fraud, not reporting a bank account in a foreign country, none of this actually speaks to Russian collusion, which I think is extremely important because under that banner, all of these investigations, these probes, this media discourse and the public narrative has been shaped.
I think that's absolutely right. It's been, you know, really something to kind of read through the mainstream media, even to read through Twitter. I mean, all of America is has their eyes on the courtroom today.
Yeah. And I have to say, going back to the question you posed earlier, I mean, we have about a minute and a half left, I think. Paul Manafort's work in Ukraine was for Yanukovych, who was a corrupt but democratically elected leader of Ukraine. He was the leader of the Party of Regions, which was based mainly in the Russian-speaking part of Ukraine, the eastern part. Paul Manafort's work in Ukraine was considered by the Kremlin, by Putin, not to be friendly, but to be unfriendly because Yanukovych was balancing between Russia and the West, balancing between Russia and the EU and, of course, the United States. And there's lots of evidence and indications, and Manafort himself has said the point of his lobbying, partly, of course, mainly to make money for himself, money that he apparently didn't want to pay taxes on, but it was also to move Yanukovych into the camp of the West. It would not have been seen by the Kremlin as a friendly gesture. But if you're in the Ukraine, if you're dealing with oligarchs, and by the way, Tony Podesta from the Podesta Group, brother of John Podesta, who is Hillary Clinton's campaign chairperson, may have also been doing work in Ukraine with Yanukovych along the same line. But again, the most important thing, Nicole, is Mueller's probe will be strengthened as a consequence of this conviction of Manafort, the guilty plea of Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's lawyer. It's going to be stronger, even though right now, none of it points to actual collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign or interference by Russia in the 2016 election. But we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Mumia Abu-Jamal has been in prison in Pennsylvania since 1981 after being accused and convicted of killing a policeman. He was on death row until 2011 when his sentence was converted to life without parole. Mumia and his supporters have always maintained his innocence, and he will be in court again next week in Philadelphia. He'll be in court on August 30th pursuing a new legal strategy that argues that Ron Castile, a former district attorney whose office prosecuted his case, was improperly involved in his appeal after Castile became a state Supreme Court justice. We're joined from New York by Dr. Johanna Fernandez. She's a professor at Baruch College and an activist with the campaign to bring Mumia home. She's also the maker of the film Justice on Trial. You can check it out this Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Maisel's Cinema in Harlem. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for having me on your show.
We're happy to have you. We were talking amongst ourselves a few minutes ago before we began recording this segment about just how important this hearing is. It's not getting a lot of press coverage outside of Philadelphia, but this hearing is so important. Why? Because it could lead to a new trial?
This is pretty much the linchpin to Mumia's freedom. And through a new trial, essentially. And I think it's important to take a step back and say that this is not just about Mumia. You probably know that political imprisonment has been in the press of late. Mumia is the most recognized Black political prisoner in the world. If there is an opening in this case, other Black political prisoners will come home. The issue that is being heard on August 30th is the Williams versus Pennsylvania issue, which is an issue involving judicial bias. Your audience might not believe it, but about 2 years ago, for the first time in the history of the United States, the Supreme Court articulated the parameters and conditions wherein one might determine what judicial bias means. And they determined that if a prosecutor later turned judge was presented with a case he had helped prosecute, he had to recuse himself. He would have to recuse himself because of the obvious bias. In this case, Williams versus Pennsylvania, the judge whom the Supreme Court determined was biased was Ronald Castile, the same exact judge involved in Mumia's case, who served as a prosecutor in Philadelphia, later became a judge in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, reviewed Mumia's appeals, and denied every single one of them. So that is known as the Williams issue, and that is what is going to be heard on August 30th.
Professor, I'm not an attorney, but this just seems to scream impropriety to me. I want to ask you if you can explain why this is even an issue. If Ron Castile was a prosecutor in Philadelphia, it just seems crystal clear that he ought to have recused himself from everything else having to do with Mumia Abu-Jamal. Why is this an issue? And would this be an issue in other states?
Well, this is now a federal law, and this just gives you a bit of insight into the insanity of the criminal justice system. There are dozens of cases in Pennsylvania alone that are coming to the courts with this exact claim. Absolutely. Ron Castile was not just the prosecutor. He was the top gun prosecutor, the elected DA of Philadelphia, which in this case is especially significant because, as you know, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is the most famous case in that city. And the city's establishment had historically been seeking Mumia's execution. The entire establishment, the police department, the mayor, the DA's office, wanted to make an example of Mumia, and they called him a cop killer. So, of course, this is really a charade. In any other venue, in the classroom, in a community center, at a church, anyone would look at this situation and see that, of course, the DA, a very politicized institution, was going to go for the jugular in the case of the most famous former Black Panther accused of killing, wrongfully accused of killing, a white police officer. Absolutely. So what needs to be proven in court is that he was involved in a significant aspect of the case. But just to give you a sense of the background on Ronald Castile, Ronald Castile was elected Man of the Year by the Fraternal Order of Police, the same institution that fought hard and lobbied hard to convict Mumia and to ensure that he got a death sentence. And in fact, because of that, Mumia's attorneys in the 1990s asked Judge Ron Castile to recuse himself because he had been identified as Man of the Year by the Fraternal Order of Police and because he had been funded, his campaign to become a judge had been funded by Ron Castile. And Ron Castile responded to Mumia's attorneys in a formal written note saying that he wasn't going to recuse himself from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court on account that he had received funds from the Fraternal Order of Police because seven other judges in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court had also received funds from the Fraternal Order of Police.
Amazing.
So this really gives you a sense that justice is really impossible in a court system that's propelled and pushed forward by police.
That's the voice of Dr. Johanna Fernandez. She's a professor at Baruch College and activist with the campaign to bring Mumia home. We're talking about Mumia's court appearance Thursday, August 30th, 8 a.m., 13th in Filbert in Philadelphia. Dr. Fernandez is also a filmmaker. She made the movie Justice on Trial. You can check it out this Thursday. If you're in the New York City area at 7 p.m. at the Maisla Cinema in Harlem, that's 343 Malcolm X Boulevard between 127th Street and 128th Street in Manhattan. Also on August 22nd, that's tomorrow, the organization in D.C. called Link Up is having an event at 300 A Street Northeast. That's tomorrow at 5 p.m. where they're going to be talking with Mumia from jail. He's able to talk for a few minutes, so activists, especially from the community, are gathering together there. Dr. Fernandez, we only have 2 minutes left. You know, one thing that's so evident in the point that you're making is that it's Ronald Castile, but it's the entire system in Philadelphia is so dominated by the police, who are so committed, almost as the top priority, to make sure that Mumia, who was a young man, formerly an information officer for the Black Panther Party in Philadelphia, which had been targeted by Rizzo and the Philadelphia cops, that he never come home. And yet, here we are back in court. This is at least a chance, because unless Mumia has the chance of a new trial, the establishment is determined that he die in prison, and people all around the world are demanding just this, a fair trial, a new trial. What's the problem? Like, anyway, 1 minute left. Go ahead.
Well, the reason why the Pennsylvania and Philadelphia establishment are committed to not give Mumia a new trial is because if he goes to trial, heads will roll in Philadelphia, in the Philadelphia political establishment. 15 of the 35 police officers involved in Mumia's case were later convicted and jailed for tampering with evidence to obtain a conviction. And just to give you a sense of the history of corruption in Philadelphia within the police department, in 1979, the Department of Justice took over the Philadelphia police because of its corruption and because of the homicidal character of its police department. And it said this, that the level of homicidal violence in the police department against African-American and Latino detainees and the level of corruption and tampering with evidence to obtain a conviction on the part of the police, quote, shocks the conscience. And that history of corruption and homicidal violence on the part of the Philadelphia police is essentially uninterrupted from really the beginning of that city's history to the present. And so if Mumia's case is on trial, the entire system, the DA's office, the police department, and all the politicians that collaborated with the police to ensure Mumia's conviction are going to be on trial.
That was the voice of Dr. Johanna Fernandez. She's a professor at Baruch College and an activist with the campaign to bring Mumia home. She's also the maker of the film Justice on Trial, and you can check it out this Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Maisel Cinema in Harlem. That's at 343 Malcolm X Boulevard between 127th and 128th Streets. Don't miss it. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a very short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
American prisoners are going on strike today all across the country. The action will continue through September 9th, which marks the anniversary of the deadly uprising at the Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York. But the strike isn't necessarily political in nature. Prisoners want to draw attention to prison conditions and exploitative labor practices, and they want their work to be valued by society. We're joined here in the studio by Alex Rubenstein. He is a Sputnik News analyst and journalist, and you can find his work on Twitter, at RealAlexRuby, R-U-B-I. Alex, welcome back.
Thank you.
Alex, every few years, there's a prison strike, or there's an attempt to make a nationwide prison strike. This one's actually working today. Tell us what you've heard.
Yeah, I mean, so the strike is going on in 17 states in the United States, and already we've seen today that the All 11 prisons run by the New Mexico Department of Corrections are on lockdown. They didn't say why, but, I mean, obviously it's because of organizing that's going on there. And really what prisoners are trying to do with this, I mean, they're engaging in work stoppages primarily. They're engaging in hunger strikes and boycotts of the commissary and of phone calls and other things like that. And they're trying to build up the collective struggle through these things. And basically, they're tired of the conditions. This prison, the strike was started in response to the uprising at Lee Correctional back in April on the 15th, and it was the deadliest event in prison history in the past 25 years, a quarter of a century. And I actually spoke to a prisoner on the inside who is organizing the strike in the week after the uprising at Lee, and he's at Lee. And what he told me is really disturbing. What he told me was that this event happened because basically guards wanted it to. What he told me was that they were trying to set up what is referred to in prisons as a gladiator match. And this is not just at Lee. I've seen it in Ohio. I've seen it in other states where basically the term he used was the guards turn the key on them. They pit rival against rival or gang against gang, blacks against whites in order to keep the prisons internally divided in order to kind of a divide and conquer strategy there.
That's right. Violence by the guards is something that's not uncommon, or violence encouraged by guards is not uncommon. And I agree, by all indications, that's what set off this riot that was so brutal and so deadly. What exactly is it that prisoners are looking for? I mentioned working conditions and value for their work in the introduction. I made 40 cents a month when I was in prison, sweeping the floors in the chapel. There were some prisoners who made less than that. You can make 25 cents a month, not a day, not an hour, 25 cents a month. Is that what this is about?
Yeah, it's about that. But it's about the conditions. I mean, also, I mean, you saw the prices in the commissary. They're sure at extortion rates. I mean, people's families are just funneling money into them to try to pay for a can of soup that's $17, you know. So it's not it's extortion in a lot of ways. And also just the way that how inhumanely these prisoners are treated. You have these situations, I call it climate punishment. A lot of people call it climate punishment. And that's a situation where you where the guards block off the windows so you don't get any natural light. They raise temperatures or lower temperatures, so you're freezing or just like boiling in your cell. They restrict your movement to the degree where you just like you don't get to see any sun at all during the day or ever. And you know, they don't clean. They don't they leave just like, you know, feces all over the place. And it's torture. Prison is just hell for a lot of people. People don't really sympathize because, you know, oh, they're criminals. But I think that, you know, what's the quote? You can judge a society by the condition of its prisons.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, we have to keep in mind, too, that experts say that as many as 85% of all incarcerated Americans are mentally ill. So this isn't just, you know, we take the worst of the worst of society and throw them into a prison just to protect Americans. That's nonsense. That's just not the way the system is set up. People are in prison. Many people are in prison because we don't have appropriate and adequate mental health care in this country.
Right. And then you have people, primarily people of color in there for drug crimes, which white people pretty much have impunity for in most areas. They're in this situation. I mean, like, I read accounts from Lee Correctional during the uprising, and this man witnessed murder, and he was in there for marijuana. I mean, the prisoners are calling for abolition, according to the one that I spoke with. But even like this basic fundamentals, if you shouldn't have a forever sentence for a petty offense.
You know, the prisoners at Attica, they started their manifesto on September 9th, 1971, with the words, "We are not beasts and we will not be driven as such." I mean, it was this fundamental existential plea for dignity, for just being treated as human beings, as opposed to being treated as, quote, criminals and thus as slaves. The 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the part of the Constitution that ends slavery as an institution in America actually maintains slavery. The 13th Amendment reads, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States. That means slavery is legal in the United States.
That's right.
For people who have been convicted of a crime. So if you've been convicted of a crime, or in the case of most prisoners, they pled guilty to a crime, because guess what? You can't win if you try to fight it. I mean, 94% of the people plead out. 98% of the people who actually, out of the next 6% who actually try to go to trial, say that they're innocent. 98% of them, 98% will be convicted, because the power of the state is the power of the state. And guess what? Prisons are for working class people in the main. They're for poor people. They're for black and Latino and poor white people. The prisons, you know, rich people commit all kinds of crimes. Every bank in America has been found guilty of laundering drug money.
Sure.
In the hundreds of billions of dollars. And not one single bank executive goes to prison for that. They get the bank itself gets fined, but the authorities who allowed it or tolerated it or profited from it, they go scot-free. So these are class-based institutions of enslaved people in America. And so we have this prison strike, Alex Rubenstein, where people are saying, we can't have a protest. We can't have a demo. We can't call the media because we don't have rights. We are enslaved people. So what we can do is rebel, or in this case, withhold our labor. But nonetheless, the prison authorities treat it as an out-and-out rebellion.
Right. And actually, you know, I want to speak about the 13th Amendment a little bit more, because what that looks like right now is that prisoners are manufacturing any kind of goods, Starbucks, coffee cups, beds, sheets, whatever, everything. But also in California right now, the Department of Corrections had a tweet the other day bragging about how more than 1,000 prisoners are fighting wildfires. That's a deadly job. And they're not given the training that that a regular firefighter would have. And they also said that 25 juvenile offenders are fighting these blazes. And I mean, that's child slavery is what it is. And even when they get out, so they have this experience, when they get out, they're not allowed to be firefighters. Prisoners aren't given education programs usually. They're just, you know, like you said, John, sweeping. I mean, that's the level of the skilled labor. It's just not skilled at all, and they're not training people to be on the outside.
So prisoners go into harm's way, fighting fires, making nothing compared to the wages of firefighters. And thus the wages of firefighters come down, because if you can rely on essentially enslaved people, that drives the wages of the so-called free labor down, because it's competing with enslaved labor.
Yeah, basically. You know, I've said before that when I was at FCI Loretto, the Federal Correctional Institution at Loretto, Pennsylvania, we had a federal, whatever it's called, Federal Industries, whatever. It's a factory attached to the prison. And so prisoners were making a communications cable for the Department of the Navy. Well, lots of companies across the country make communications cable for the military. But how are they going to compete against a company that pays its workers a dollar a day or 50 cents a day? They can't compete. And as a result, legitimate companies that have hired Americans and have paid taxes and put people to work were being driven out of business.
What we need, and I think we're out of time, sadly, is that the U.S. labor movement has to recognize that the prisons are a format, a place of labor organizing right now. The prisoners are the workers. The labor movement should be standing with these workers who are carrying out a wildcat strike against enslavement.
Amen. We'll leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Alex Rubenstein. He's a Sputnik News analyst and journalist, and you can find his work on Twitter at RealAlexRuby. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we're going to talk about the anniversary of the assassination of George Jackson. George Jackson was a leader of the Black Panther Party while incarcerated. He became the principal, perhaps the most important voice of prisoners, and especially African-American prisoners, during the period of the late 1960s and early 1970s. We're joined from Houston by Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including Blows Against the Empire, U.S. Imperialism in Crisis. Dr. Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for joining. Dr. Horn, George Jackson, perhaps I would say one of the top, well, certainly within the prison movement, the top voice at that time, but within the general black liberation movement, also one of the principal voices. Talk about George Jackson's legacy.
Well, his legacy lives on. I'm sure you realize that his books, Blood in My Eye and Soledad Brother, are still selling in significant numbers. You may recall that he was jailed in San Quentin some years ago on what appears to be spurious charges, but he remade himself, he reinvented himself, not unlike one of his predecessors. I'm speaking of the man who became Malcolm X. He has been celebrated in popular culture. Bob Dylan did a song about George Jackson. Archie Shepp, the great jazz saxophonist, did a tune about George Jackson. And in fact, it's quite remarkable to note that the Archie Shepp tune is on his album, Attica Blues, which is striking because, as I'm sure you recall, after George Jackson was killed under very suspicious circumstances in California, that led directly to the Attica Uprising in upstate New York, which led to the slaughter of numerous prisoners. And I should also say that as we speak, a prison strike is unfolding in the United States of America.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. We're talking about George Jackson on this, the 47th anniversary of his, I would say, execution by guards in prison in California. Dr. Horn, I was living in Rochester, New York, and part of something called the Prisoners Solidarity Committee at that time. And 2.5 weeks later, there was, as you mentioned, a rebellion in Attica Prison, which became the premier Attica rebellion among prisoners. The prisoners took D Block. 1,500 people participated. At the end, Nelson Rockefeller ordered the retaking of the prison rather than further negotiations with the prisoners that had been going on for 3 days. And 43 people were killed, including 10 guards who were also killed by police bullets, not by prisoners. But what people may not know is that that rebellion that happened in Attica on September 9th, 1971, was preceded by a nationwide strike and a lockdown of prisoners all over the country, because the prison authorities feared, and the prisoners themselves were inspired by, the image, the impression, the struggle of George Jackson. And he was, of course, also a leader in the Black Panther Party, although in prison.
I think we need to understand George Jackson and understand the movement that he came to symbolize by putting this in a broader and wider context. That is to say, historically, there has been a very powerful and potent movement of prisoners in the United States of America, which should come as no shock or surprise, given the fact that the United States is the heavyweight champion in terms of incarcerating its own citizens, particularly incarcerating its citizens of African descent. You may recall the Scottsboro case of the 1930s, which involved black prisoners, and the cases that were fought on behalf of the Scottsboro Nine, as they were called, led to an expansion of rights, not only for black people, but for all who were arrested and detained by the authorities. So we should take very seriously this question of the prisoner strike that's unfolding as we speak. And also, I think it's quite appropriate that we're honoring and marking the mysterious death of George Jackson some decades ago.
Gerald Horn, Dr. Gerald Horn, prolific author, is our guest. We're talking about the legacy of George Jackson. George Jackson was arrested as a 19-year-old for participating in what the police said was an armed robbery. He stole $70 at gunpoint from a gas station as a 19-year-old. And this is an amazing part of the story. His sentence was, for $70 theft, 1 year to life in prison. That's what his sentence was. And then as George Jackson became politicized in prison, started organizing other prisoners, they just kept adding on. So even though he was arrested as a 19-year-old for a $70 gas station robbery, He was going to spend the rest of his life in prison, and he knew that because that's how the prison authorities dealt with, quote, rebellious prisoners.
Troublemakers.
Yeah, troublemakers. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, George Jackson not only inspired prisoners, but he was a close friend of Angela Davis. He was an inspiration to the larger, not just the Black Liberation Movement, but all of those who were sort of brought into political life as a consequence of that struggle. I have to agree with you, Dr. Horn. I just met someone, a young man who was about 22 years old. He just got out of jail here in the Washington, D.C. area. And when I met him, he was reading A Soledad Brother. I mean, that's what he was reading. And undoubtedly, some of his other colleagues, young men who were in D.C. or suburban Maryland jails, also reading George Jackson. The fact that he exists as a man of letters, because otherwise we couldn't hear him. I mean, we couldn't see him. He was behind bars. I mean, it shows the profound capacity of people even in prison to make change.
You are correct. And speaking of being able to see George Jackson, I was just able to screen the documentary, The House on Cocoa Road, which deals with a Northern California family, which had ties indirectly to George Jackson, but then got caught up in the Grenadian Revolution. And I mentioned that because there is footage of George Jackson in that movie that I had never seen before. And so those who would like to see what this man looked like and hear his words can go and screen that film, The House on Cocoa Road. I should also say that George Jackson, as you suggested, was a man of letters. He was also a revolutionary. He was quite frank and candid about being influenced by Marx and Engels and Ho Chi Minh, for example. He, as you note, was a leader of the Black Panther Party, particularly during its most militant phase. And in fact, it's not unfair to suggest that the killing of George Jackson was in part a major blow against the Black Panther Party and helped to ensure that that party would not realize its great and significant promise.
And Dr. Horn, as we come to our last 2 minutes, George Jackson was also the older brother of Jonathan Jackson, who, of course, was killed 1 year earlier, August 7th, 1970, in a case where he was trying to free his brother and other people he considered to be political prisoners. He took a judge, a juror, and a prosecutor hostage at the Marin County Courthouse in Northern California. They thought they were on their way out, but instead the California, I think it was state police, surrounded and shot everybody. And then everybody, with the exception of Rochelle McGee, who's still in prison today, they all died. And from that incident came the Angela Davis prosecution. Angela Davis went to prison. Anyway, talk about that a little bit, if you would. We have about 90 seconds left.
Well, you are correct in your recitation of the facts. I should also mention that it was a worldwide movement that led to the freedom of Professor Davis. And I should also say that a leader of that worldwide movement was the Black lawyer from San Francisco, William Patterson, who also happened to be a leader of the case that led to the vindication of the Scottsboro Nine, mentioned just a moment or two ago. So I think it's quite appropriate for us on this day to mark the killing of George Jackson because he touched many lives and was a man of great significance.
And he was, you know, he was just shot down. I mean, there's a lot of controversy about what happened. His lawyer was indicted for having brought in a gun. Then he was eventually exonerated. But it seemed to all of us at the time that this was just plain and simple. The California state prison authorities or others decided it was time for George Jackson to be killed.
Well, I have to confess, the cover story that the prison authorities put forward barely passes the giggle test. Supposedly, Mr. Jackson was able to gain an Afro wig and gain a pistol, and he placed the pistol in this Afro wig and then engaged in a shootout with the prison guards. This is the cover story that they put forward. This is the cover story that they continue to put forward. And I think that if there's any justice, there should be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that investigates and establishes the true facts as to who killed George Jackson and why he was killed.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important. We just kind of assume, well, of course the government killed George Jackson. It came after the killing of Dr. Martin Luther King, the killing of Malcolm X, the killing of Medgar Evers. Of course, there was also the in the same year, not only was King killed, but Robert Kennedy was killed, which impacted on the 68 elections. I mean, it was a period of great political instability, but certainly premier paramount leaders of the black movement or the black liberation movement were just so targeted. 20 seconds left. Dr. Horn, you take us out if you would.
Well, I don't think we should ever forget that George Jackson's killing, as you already have suggested, was a precursor to the bloody overthrow of the Attica uprising in September, weeks after George Jackson was killed. And we should mark both events as we are doing today.
All right. That's the voice of Dr. Gerald Horn. And as Dr. Horn mentioned today, a prison strike. Very fitting that it should happen now, August 21st, the 47th anniversary of the execution of George Jackson. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Voting rights activists in Georgia are decrying a state plan to close two-thirds of the polling stations in a predominantly black county. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a formal protest with the county's electoral board, and even the Republican nominee for governor has urged officials to abandon the plan. We're joined from Atlanta by Anoa Chenga. She's the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army, and she's also the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. Anoa, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Anoa, everybody's covered this story today, all the major papers, and it just sounds like so transparently racist. What was this county board thinking? What's their reasoning behind closing all of these polling stations?
It is really racist, right? I mean, and one thing, I'm really glad that everyone's covering it and focusing on what's happening down here in Georgia. But the one reminder I had when I sat down in the meeting last Thursday, because I did get a chance to drive down to Randolph County last week, was that this is an ongoing, like, voting rights. This is something that we have to constantly be battling, particularly post Shelby, right? I never imagined that our generation would have to be carrying this mantle and fighting and organizing so hard. Like, you literally have people fighting right now, canvassing to get enough signatures to kind of overrule this just in case the board votes, you know, to go ahead and make these closures. So what are they thinking? Sat there through the presentation and, you know, let's just, to be clear, the county board of electors were short. They're a three-person board. They were short one member. They only had two members. They needed someone to come in and help them. They apparently got a recommendation from the Secretary of State's office during the Thursday meeting that I attended. It was explicitly said that Brian Kemp actually recommended Mike Malone, who is the consultant that has been spearheading this effort. And the presentation, despite the fact that, you know, I have video up on my Twitter timeline of the chair of the board saying, you know, we haven't decided anything. We need your help. We need your suggestions. I mean, that's a week before they're slated to vote. They're talking about they want help and suggestions. That doesn't really sound like a sincere, we haven't made up our minds. So the allegedly, from what they claim is that, you know, maintaining these polling locations and there's low voter turnout. We know that we have low voter turnout in, you know, low income, you know, high poverty areas. And sometimes in rural areas, we tend to have low voter turnout because we're not just engaging voters. So that's a separate issue, right? But that was kind of used to also say that, okay, the cost-benefit analysis allegedly was what they tried to say. It makes sense to close these polls because you don't have the many people going to them anyway, which wasn't true. Some of them, you didn't have many people using them, but the measure wasn't even the same, right? They were comparing across multiple different elections. So across general elections and across, you know, primaries, and then we have runoff elections here in Georgia as well.
And where you get 10% turnout in some of those cases.
Right. You can't even, especially if these aren't major presidential election cycles. You know, I mean, this is an issue we see happening. But instead of trying to grapple with what that really means in terms of our electorate, their attitude is, well, people are voting, you know, more early in person or absentee, so we don't need polling locations at all. And I mean, there's a whole lot of issues, particularly with the voter suppression issues we have with our state and our Secretary of State in general, and whether or not, you know, you can trust, you know, I mean, there's just a whole lot here. So that was it was interesting that you had a presentation that was about the cost savings that showed no numbers, right? There was no numbers, there was no estimate of what it would cost to fix any of the issues in these polling locations. Like, I just Googled it and looked it up, ADA compliance in polling locations. There's like even a workbook online. It talks about temporary measures that you can do for a polling location. And to be clear, less than a month ago, these locations were used for the runoff, which also contained the Republican governor runoff, which Kemp just won. So these polling locations were in fact just open like less than a month ago. And have had these issues, you know, people were saying in the audience, like, yeah, these issues have been there. Where y'all been at? But the other thing is that some of these places are fire stations. There's one middle school. So if there is ADA compliance issues, why are we not concerned for the functional uses these buildings are supposed to have in terms of their public value and service? So there's all this stuff. And, you know, the consultant, Mike Malone, who's recommended by Brian Kemp, kept saying things like there's no one is worried about voter disenfranchisement. And again, he's speaking to an audience full of residents of Randolph County who were very much concerned about this. So there was never any consideration of alternative sites nearby. That was something that many folks in the audience said, that, you know, there were churches nearby that could have been looked at. All of the sites, with the exception of one, were 6 miles or more away from their existing location. Two were over 10 miles. It was 10 miles and 15 miles, respectively, from where the proposed change, difference in change. So something that has been, you know, discussed in some of the testimony by NSAE OFOT from New Georgia Project, as well as been reported in the news, is that, you know, people, and Sean Young from the ACLU said this as well, you know, you have a high ratio of people who don't have cars. There are a lot of people who are able to walk to their polling places as they are now. Accessibility is a major issue when you're talking about, you know, a lower income, you know, high poverty area. And this is something that should be taken into consideration, but it's not. And there were some really flippant remarks from the consultant during this meeting that I guess they pulled it together and were a little bit better and more composed by the Friday meeting they had. And I'll just note, it was astonishing to me that, given the gravity of this situation, that the chair and the consultant kept reminding the community that these meetings were optional and they didn't have to be there. Like, there's a really serious problem that we have in states where we treat, and America is supposedly how great this democracy is, when we treat voting rights and people's access to participate in the process as optional.
Anoa Changa is our guest. We're talking about the decision to close 2/3 of the polling places in Randolph County, majority Black, 55% Black residents, mostly low-income county. Let's talk about Georgia politics, too. I mean, Stacey Abrams, a former state legislator, is seeking to become the nation's first African-American female governor. Is this political? I mean, in an immediate sense?
It's absolutely political. It's not just the fact. I mean, when you find out also in the course of this that Brian Kemp has quietly been encouraging Mike Malone to push this plan of consolidating polling locations. I mean, there's an article from 2016 that also talked about Georgia that looked at the fact that polling location closures are another type of voter suppression. When you look at the history of Brian Kemp and the fact that, I mean, really, when you look at, you know, the great battles and like movies and stuff, you think about someone going up against their arch nemesis. I mean, Brian Kemp has been gunning for Stacey Abrams in the New Georgia Project since 2014, when she created the organization to increase engagement and voter registration amongst marginalized communities in the state of Georgia, right? So when you're looking at what we're up against right now, and he's a horrible candidate, right? So we're looking at what we're up against. He's refusing to step down as Secretary of State. He essentially is overseeing the election in which he's also running for the highest office in the state. I mean, there's so much ethically wrong here. So it's not surprising that he's willing to go to any lengths to win. However, what is not being talked about enough is that particular district. That is Georgia House District 151. That district has had the same incumbent since he was elected in 1982, Gerald Green, a Republican. Gerald Green was elected in 1982. He was sworn in 1983. So he's an over 30-year incumbent. And there was no Democratic opponent in 2016. There is a Democratic challenger right now, Joyce Barlow, who is also running, and just looking at the possibility for what we're seeing in terms of the turnout and what Abrams is building statewide and closing the gap. The House District 151, which is directly impacted by what happens in Randolph County, could potentially shift hands for the first time in over 30 years. So we could really see the balance of power shift in Southwest Georgia for the first time in over 30 years. And so there really is a larger a picture at what's at stake. But we're seeing this not just across, you know, Georgia. We're seeing this. I mean, you have, while it's not this specific issue, you have issues in terms of redistricting and de-annexation of a city and removal of the tax base of a majority Black city, Stockbridge, that is ongoing right now. That's House District 111 that has another strong Democratic contender, El Mahdi Holly. I mean, there's so much that's happening right now in Georgia, but we're seeing this in varying forms across the South. And I mean, really, you see it across the country, but really, when we're looking at the South, and there's a radical Black organizing South that does not get the attention from the media or even from, you know, mainstream political elites that has been actively maintaining and fighting since the 60s, really, or earlier. And so when we're looking at what's happening, we're looking at what Abrams is building, we're looking at what other candidates are building into. This is definitely an attempt to kind of pick here and there to hopefully whatever, you know, and I really do believe that the Republicans are trying to make sure that whatever gains that Abrams and those who are organizing alongside her to expand the electorate, that they can try and trim the gains so that, you know, she won't cross that threshold. And it's just motivating people even more to not only, you know, quote unquote, defeat the Republicans, but also communicate and engage people on the issues, because you're not just disenfranchising, you know, potentially, even though it's a majority Black county, we're looking at some of the other counties. When we're talking about rural communities are diverse, right? So we're talking about, you know, the racial component of it can't be overlooked, but, you know, the economic degradation and marginalization cannot be overlooked as well, right?
And these they don't want poor people or people of color to vote, because that could, with these demographic changes we've seen recently, that could change the whole complexion of the state of Georgia. Unfortunately, we're out of time, though. We were joined from Atlanta by Anoa Changa. Anoa is the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army, and she's also the host of the show The Way with Anoa. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, at iHeartRadio, and now at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.